it's from the province, and it says Northern Lights appear in southwestern BC sky. And this says a time exposure of Aurora Borealis at Island View Beach in central Saanich. So it's possible it was better seen in on the island. And it shows a time exposure of some nice green lights, not as fancy or as not, they don't dance as much as other auroras that I have seen on TV, but still quite spectacular. I wish I looked in the sky yesterday, couldn't see them. So this was in the southwestern sky. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about that and read the article. So again, it's in the province. Northern Lights appear in southwestern BC sky. Okay, here goes the article. It doesn't happen often in southwestern BC, but nighttime observers the past few nights have been treated to the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, and Karen Thanjavar, a senior lab instructor for the University of Victoria's Department of Physics and Astronomy, was holding out hope for another show overnight Tuesday. So says Karen Thanjavar, an instructor, University of Victoria, and quote, "This is quite far down south," he said. "All put together, it was fairly uncommon to see aurora at this time of the year from Victoria," end quote. I recall a story, it could have been in the, there was one where there was a magnetic storm from the sun and it really lit up the sky. People in Miami and Cuba saw the sky dancing all kinds of colors. And there was another time where there was a really bad magnetic storm. I recall a time of 1850 where that happened. And again, that one, the telegraph lines picked up the signal from the aurora, and apparently it fried people inside the telegraph offices. So they caught fire from the Aurora Borealis. So you can see it when, it'll explain later in the article. I'll just read the article instead of trying to explain in my own convoluted, warped way about what an aurora is. A storm in the sun contributed to the appearance, Thanjavar said. So says Thanjavar again, the sun is a very active star. It looks like the storm is abating right now, which means the activity will die off, end quote. So there's auroras that spacecraft up there have seen in Saturn and Jupiter, and they're quite magnificent, much stronger than here. The phenomena of northern and southern lights happens when gases and material break away from the sun, Thanjavar said. Because these are charged particles, the Earth's magnetic field diverts those particles towards the north and the south pole, end quote. So this is what I always thought. The magnetosphere in that is generated by subsurface motion of like lava and stuff, so that would be ions in the lava that circulate around the core of our Earth, that's a moving charge, so that's a electric charge that moves. So that creates a magnetic field, so that is what protects partially, one of the things that protects us on Earth from radiation and matter in outer space. So what I believed was from the sun is the protons and the electrons and charged particles are shot up off of the sun. They travel a million miles an hour. And so they hit the Earth, not the Earth, they hit the Earth's magnetic field. And some of them might soak through or bleed through, but I think most of it is the magnetosphere is not a round ball. It's round through part of it, most of it, I believe, but towards the end, it's like a teardrop, so it's got a tail, like a tadpole or something. So what happens, the magnetic particles keep traveling down, and then they sneak in the back end of the magnetosphere, and then they make their way up to the North Pole and the South Pole, or they just circulate, these particles circulate around the magnetic field around the Earth, and that creates the Northern Light. To see the Aurora Borealis in this region, it is best to be in the dark area and cast your eyes north, low to the horizon. That's because this is happening mainly up north, and we are at 40 degrees, so we are way off from the north. When I was in Prince Rupert, I tried to see the Northern Lights, but I was in Prince Rupert in the summer in June or July, so I don't think the Northern Lights happen as much. Well, now it's August, so it's happening down here. But I believe the best time to see the Northern Lights are go way up north in the winter, and then you can maybe see them. Maybe. It's not always a sure bet. But when I was up there in Rupert, the sun really never set. It set, but there was always a big, bright streak of light across the sky. So I believe the further north you go, the brighter it gets. And until you get to a point, I don't know what the latitude is or the whatever it is, but the sun never sets in the summer. So chances are it would be best to be seen in a picture taken. Guess what? A flyer from Napa Auto Parts just popped up on my screen. So I don't want to look at that, so I X'd it out, closed it. In Vancouver, it's a bit tricky to see the Northern Lights given the light pollution and the mountains in the north, said Michael Unger, programs coordinator at the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, though he said he has heard from several people who saw the show over the last two nights in the city and said it may be still, though he said he, the English in the sentence, not very good. He said he heard from several people who saw the, and guess what? Napa Auto Parts just sprung up again. They really want me to see their ad, don't they? Okay, so he said he has heard from several people who saw the show over the last two nights, so it still may be possible to get a glimpse Wednesday night. I tried to look, and I looked in the southwestern. See, that's what's wrong. It says in the southwestern part of BC. I should have looked in the northern sky. It's not the southwestern sky. It is the northern sky. Okay, I'll try again tonight. Maybe we won't take it or won't be able to see it. So says, Michael Unger, and quote, you need to be in the right place at the right time. Closer to the water can be a really great place to see them because you have more sky to look to the north. Another place he recommends is a wide open park, such as McDonald, the Dark Sky Park in Aldergrove. Sky watchers have more to look forward to this week. The annual July-August appearance of the Perseid meteor shower is expected to reach its peak. It is the debris from a comet orbiting the sun. The Earth passes through the debris. So this happens regular every year, once a year, and there's quite a few meteor showers. The comet is Swift Tuttle, and the meteor shower is named for the constellation Perseus. According to earthsky.org, some of the best viewing will be in the morning on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If you're in the city, you'll only be seeing the brighter ones. So that's interesting sky phenomena. And I could just imagine what it'd be like in the future if people do, let's say, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, if they go up into the sky or if they go up and visit other planets, what kind of beautiful things you can see. And of course, what I do recall is what astronauts were saying that they saw was the Earth when they went around the moon and they came out from behind the moon. All of a sudden, they would see a beautiful Earth, and it was quite amazing. And there's been other comets that have tried to get pictures of the Earth and things like that, and or other spacecraft that have been really far away, and then the Earth is a little dot, so small sometimes it takes a while to see them. So that makes me recall the other day they were talking about, and this is talked about often enough, why have we not seen or met another civilization? If they do exist, why haven't we met them? Well, imagine we have a spacecraft that goes to Jupiter or Saturn, and it is at Neptune, the spacecraft is 30 times farther from the distance from the Earth to the sun. So the distance from the Earth to the sun is one astronomical unit. So from Neptune, we have 30 astronomical units to get to Neptune. So imagine we're at Neptune and we're looking back at the Earth, and it's a small little dot. It's really hard to see. You have to know where you're looking, and it sometimes, if someone were given a picture, they might not be able to find it. So then imagine this. We have our solar system, which reaches far beyond Neptune. And then we're in our, we have our planets, we have our sun, and then the nearest star to us is 4.3 light years away. So imagine we're 30 astronomical units from the sun. We're at Neptune and we can barely see Earth. So how can, at 4.3 light years away is the next star system. And I often have it on the tip of my tongue, and I'm trying to remember it now. But anyway, imagine there is a planet there that hosts life, and there is an intelligent species there, and they're looking through their telescope. And we can barely see our Earth at Neptune. Imagine what kind of luck they would have trying to spot our Earth. And then there's the other part of, well, what if we send signals out, like Chuck Berry or Lucy Show, and they are... they are received by another race. Well, when we look head-on at solar systems that are now forming in outer space, they are very far away, and they're in a different time frame. So it could take 5, 10, 20, 50 million years for life to form, if it does form at all. It could take a billion. And by that time, we're snuffed out. We're not even here anymore. So it's difficult to... it just brought that up because... people are saying, oh, well, if we, I believe it's called the Fermi paradox, if there is intelligent life out there, why has it not contacted us? So I'm going to try this again. I'm going to put some music there, and hopefully it will play. So I'll try it now. I will go now. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR. Just wait, give me a sec. I have to look at Sam PC. Where is Sam PC? Sam PC is right there. Okay, so I'm going to try to play a song now. If I don't, I'll come right back. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Hi, I'm back. I tried to play the song, it didn't play, and this happens before. So sometimes the songs don't play. So I'll try to, I don't know what I can do. Okay, let's see. I'll try this. I have a song here. I'll put it in there, and we'll see if it plays. So this is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CATR 101.9.
Me too bad, ask about me sense. Play a game if them ever play with me name. It's a shame, cause them mother I go cry in a vein in a rain. You see the last girl, you this and all this bloodline line up. If you this, them I switch.
What you think?
357 cut your life in a half. Like wood me turn up, she feel no me not soft. Me a real down, got up. Me like your like grabber.
Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get aggressive. Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get senseless. Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get aggressive. Look how you make me feel. Look how you make me get senseless.
You're back on AstroTalk with Marco and Stefflon Don on CITR 101.9. Hi, this is Marco. You're back on AstroTalk. That was Stefflon Don. So I got it to work because I put an MP3 there, but earlier it didn't work. So, okay. So I'm back. Not as long as a break as I could have wanted. Let's see. I'll try to, well, let's see. What were they called? Not ambidextrous. Am I a multitasker? Could I talk to you and try to get something going here? Doesn't look like it. Okay, so now I'll go to my favorite website, which is nasa.gov, which, surprise, surprise, is already open. So, of course, we know about the tragedies in America, the shooting tragedies, and all the bad things that happens. And today another man killed four with a knife, didn't use a gun, but something's wrong down there, how they keep doing this. Okay, so why did I bring that up? Oh yeah, they had a forum where they were talking about gun violence, and for some reason somebody brought up Mars, and they said, why are we going to Mars? Let's spend the money that we're going to spend on going to Mars to try to fix this problem. Well, I guess I can comment on that. I don't think you can stop science for one thing and then stop it for another thing and stop it for the next thing. And one of my favorite things that I'd like to say now with the Apollo 50th anniversary of the moon landings is that there were computers that were the size of this whole CITR office. So they were very big in the 60s, and I believe they had vacuum tubes and all this, and they were so big, and NASA had a job to do. It had to take a computer that size and miniaturize it to 1 cubic meter by 1 cubic meter by 1 cubic meter. So they did that. So they miniaturized electronics, and that benefited the whole Earth. And believe me, if we didn't have NASA satellites in the sky, our society would go dead. We talk on cell phones. So it's a topic that often comes up. And for a lot of things, they say, well, we have this problem. We have homeless. We have drug problem. Why are we spending money to go in outer space when we can solve these problems? Well, we have to advance science, and we are going to live off the Earth one day. That's almost a certainty, because the Earth is getting more and more unlivable. And one day, like Stephen Hawking said, he thinks we have 100 years left on the Earth. So we are a spacefaring race, and we got to start living in outer space. We will. We have to. We'll be forced to. Sorry, I dropped my glasses. And then, of course, when you drop your glasses, you can't see, so you can't find them. Okay, so I'm going to read an article about, it shows when men first went on the moon, and they're jumping around. It looks pretty funny, actually, doesn't it? They're planting a flag and they're running around. So this is an article, August 7, 2019, how NASA will protect astronauts from space radiation at the moon. August 1972, as NASA scientist Ian Richardson, remember it, was hot in Surrey, England, where he grew up. The fields were brown and dry, and people tried to stay indoors, out of the sun. Television's on. But for several days that month, his TV picture kept breaking up. Do not adjust your set, he recalls the BBC announcing. Heat isn't causing the interference. It's sunspots, end quote. So again, that's another thing. We have to learn about outer space, because sunspots, the cycle of the sun, it affects us. And what if we have a giant storm one day coming at us? Do we learn how to mitigate that? Do we learn how to mitigate how an asteroid comes at us? That could be a planet killer. So we can't just stop space. And I don't think stopping space programs would cure the American problem with guns, because I think one of the problems is the two political parties just are so far apart, they can't agree. And what the status quo now is don't regulate guns at all. And the Republicans and the National Rifle Association, just after every shooting, they just seems count on the fact that after a few days, after a few weeks, it'll die down a bit, and there won't be the appetite to make gun control. So you can't just say, okay, let's kill the Mars program, let's not launch James Webb Space Telescope, because just another example, sunspots. If a big storm comes at us and we know how to mitigate the effects of the storm, that would save us so much more money than we ever dreamt of putting into it. So I'll continue in the article. So again, it says, how NASA will protect astronauts from space radiation at the moon. It's dated August 7, 2019. So the same sunspot that disrupted the television signals led to enormous solar flares, powerful bursts of energy from the sun, August 4th to August 7th that year. Between the Apollo 16 and 17 missions, the solar eruptions were a near miss for lunar explorers. Had they been in orbit or on the moon's surface, they could have experience high level of radiation sparked by the eruptions. Today, the Apollo era flares serve as a reminder of the threat of radiation exposure to technology and astronauts in space. Understanding and predicting solar eruptions is crucial for safe space exploration. Almost 50 years ago, since these 1972 storms, the data, technology, and resources available to NASA have improved, enabling advancements towards space weather forecasts and astronaut protection, key to NASA's Artemis program to return astronauts to the moon. I thought it was called the Gateway program, so I'm wrong. Okay, so there's a photo here driving me nuts. It's an astronaut hopping across the moon. It's a done it at fast speed. He hops across, helps plant the flag, and then he does it again. And it just keeps playing over and over, and it drives me crazy. So I had to bring that down so I wouldn't see that. It's driving me nuts. So here's a video here. It says, protecting astronauts from space radiation. So space radiation is a key factor for astronaut safety as they venture to the moon. NASA is exploring a variety of techniques and technology to mitigate different types of radiation during space travel. Different types of radiation. Wow. Space isn't empty. Today, Richardson is a scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He studies high-energy particles that burst from the sun in the wake of giant solar eruptions. In addition to flares, huge clouds called coronal mass ejections containing a billion tons of solar material occasionally blast from the solar surface. Increasingly, scientists think coronal mass ejections play a dominant role in driving the sun's most powerful radiation, solar energetic particles, or SEPs. First time I've heard of SEPs. Oops, I just dropped the glasses, so I'll try to do without them. SEPs are almost all protons, flung at such high speeds that some reach Earth 93 million miles away in less than an hour. So they look like they're going about 100 million miles an hour. When a high-speed boat goes through water, you can see the wave ahead of it. The shock waves ahead of fast coronal mass ejections accelerate particles before them. So it's just not the protons that are being ejected. So like a boat, when the boat goes through the water, you can see the wave ahead of it. So these shock waves ahead of fast coronal mass ejections accelerate particles before them. So there's other particles in space that are ejected or accelerated towards Earth. Radiation is energy packaged in electromagnetic waves or carried by particles. The energy is handed off when the wave or particle runs into something else, like an astronaut or spacecraft component. SEPs, which are solar... Oh, it said here what SEPs are. Solar energetic particles. Okay, solar energetic particles, SEPs. SEPs are dangerous because they pass right through skin, shedding energy and fragmenting cells or DNA on their way. This damage can increase risk for cancer later in life, or in extreme cases, cause acute radiation sickness in the short term. On Earth, humans are safe from this harm. Earth's protective magnetic bubble, which is called the magnetosphere, deflects most solar particles. The atmosphere also quells any particles that do make it through. The atmosphere also helps. The International Space Station cruises through low Earth orbit within Earth's protection, and the station's hull helps shield crew members from radiation too. But beyond Earth's magnetic reach, human explorers can face the harsh radiation of space. So says Ruthin Lewis, a Goddard architect and engineer for NASA's human spaceflight program, and quote, "The danger of radiation is always present, whether you're in orbit, in transit, or on a planetary surface. From mitigation techniques to protection and enclosures, we're considering this in every environment astronauts will be in." So now, as a subtitle, it says Space Lifeguard. It shows someone, Jessica Voss, a deputy health and medical technical authority for Orion. So Orion is a spacecraft that's going to bring us to the moon and Mars. An astronaut, Anne McLean, demonstrate the radiation protection plan in a representative Orion spacecraft. during an SEP event. So again, I'm going to solar energetic particle, SEP. So during an SEP event, the crew will use stowage bags on board Orion to create a dense shelter from radiation. So of course, that's something when you're going to the moon, you're there a couple of days maybe, or the astronauts were there before. And then when you're in the International Space Station, you're protected by the magnetosphere and part of Earth's atmosphere. But if astronauts do go to Mars, that's one issue, how to protect from space radiation. In a room filled with expansive computer screens and blinking light, at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, scientists work day shifts to monitor space weather conditions for astronauts on the space station, known as... So wait, I'm going to read that again because I didn't really get that. Okay, so it's under a subtitle called Space Lifeguard. In a room filled with expansive computer screens and blinking light at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. So they're in a room with computer screens and blinking lights. Scientists work daily shifts to monitor space weather conditions for astronauts on the space station, known as space environment officers. They're the lifeguards of space. Instead of tidal waves and rip currents, they keep watch for the ebb and flow of space radiation. Oh, that's interesting. So they're inside a room with their computer screen. They're monitoring space radiation. Each day, the scientists who are part of Johnson Space Radiation Analysis Group check the space weather forecast from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Protection Center. They alert mission control of potential solar activity. If solar energetic particles are ramping up and the space station happens to be passing outside Earth's magnetic protection, they might recommend postponing activities that require leaving the safety of the station. Anywhere astronauts go, the group will keep watch over their space environment. Oh, so that's interesting. So they have a little thing in Houston, a little room where they watch space weather. They keep track of the radiation in outer space. During a future Artemis mission, if a solar radiation squall were to occur while astronauts are beyond Earth's magnetic bubble, they might tell the crew to build a temporary shelter. So says Johnson scientist Kerry Lee, and quote, "Our strategy in space is to make use of whatever mass is available. We're redistributing mass to fill in areas that are thinly shielded and getting crew members closer to the heavily shielded areas," end quote. The more mass between the crew and radiation, the more likely that dangerous particles will deposit their energy before reaching the crew. On the moon, astronauts could pile lunar soil or regolith over their shelters, taking advantage of their environment's natural shielding materials. So I guess the same thing happens whenever you see a movie and someone's going to ignite an atomic bomb. They say, go inside this tunnel, go underground, go, I guess one of them, I think it was John Travolta, and I forget the other guy's name, but John Travolta stole the nuclear weapon. He was gonna ignite it. So the train went in a tunnel so it could shield it from the radiation. So I guess that's what happens here. So they'll have to get mass between themselves and the radiation. And if you're on the moon, you can pile regolith on top, and it seems that will absorb some of the radiation. The more mass between the crew and radiation, the more likely that dangerous particles will deposit their energy before reaching the crew. The Johnson teams work on developing shielding methods without adding more material. So says Lee, and quote, "It's unlikely that we're going to be able to fly dedicated radiation shielding mass. Every item you fly will have to be multi-purpose," end quote. For the Orion spacecraft, they designed a plan for astronauts to build a temporary shelter with existing materials on hand, including storage units already on board, or food and water supplies. If the sun erupted with another storm as strong as the Apollo Eras, the Orion crew would be safe and sound. Other teams across NASA are meeting the radiation challenge with creative solutions. developing technologies such as wearable vests and devices that add mass, and electrically charged surfaces that deflect radiation. So I'm just going to go on a side now, and Star Trek, what's it called, Voyager, Deep Space Nine, just Star Trek, whatever movie you have these big giant spacecraft that hold thousands of people. That's amazing if we're going to get to that one day. And, oh, I just recalled the star system close to us. It's called Proxima Centauri, so I got to remember that. I know what it is. It just sometimes it's just goes off the tip of my tongue. So, yes, if we have to go to Mars, or if, let's say, 15 years from now, we have a space mission outside of Mars to Jupiter or Saturn, and we have these big spacecraft, that is something that will have to be developed over time. So what I'm going to do now, I am going to go for a break. And as I said, for some reason, this thing is not cooperating with me. It's just not doing what I want. So let's see. I'm going to get a station ID. I'm going to put it there, and hopefully it will play it. So I'm going to go for a break now. I'm going to listen. If it plays, hip hip hooray and yippee and all that stuff, right? So I'll try it now. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
It's raining in my Stephanie's grade 2 class at Selkirk Elementary, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Tune in to African Rhythms every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock. With your host, David Love Jones, as he plays a heavyweight selection of classics from the past, present, and future. This includes jazz, soul, hip-hop, Afro-Latin, funk, and eclectic Brazilian rhythms.
Lots of people, they take it like a game.
Hi, I'm back. For some reason, this thing doesn't want to, so I'm going to try to trick it. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to move something. Let's see, am I doing something wrong? Okay, so that could be what I'm doing wrong. Okay, so I'm going to try again. This is Marco. I'm going to try to play another song on CITR 101.9. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9 with Marco and Sugar.
Time for some action. I got to be the main attraction. Blowing up like Tony Braxton. Pick my girls up to check the party uptown. I leave my shorty home because I'm trying to buy at the sports bar. Honey's everywhere and looking mink. What's up, star? Let's get a drink. What's up, star?
Get with this kid, and if you're lucky, you can hit this. But don't get sued. It's just a conversation at the bar, star. And if you slip, you get the sizzle.
Rocco, and you're listening to Sugar. What's up, Star?
What's up, Star?
I like to get to know who you are. Let's have drinks at the bar. I used to always watch that on Soul Train. My life before, about 20 years of my life was devoted to listening to music in the day and dancing to music at night. Good memories, good years. Okay, so I'm going to talk about something else. I'm going to talk about, keep it in the solar system. I'm going to talk about Hubble's new portrait of Jupiter. So it's a beautiful picture. And remember, before the Hubble Space Telescope, before the Voyager spacecraft went up and saw Jupiter up close, or before the Voyager saw Jupiter up close, and before Hubble could exist and see this beautiful picture, we didn't know anything about Jupiter. Didn't know much, so now we know a lot more. So it has a nice picture. And this article is dated August 8th on NASA.gov. It says, Hubble's new portrait of Jupiter. And it's a beautiful picture, and the caption below says, the new Hubble Space Telescope view of Jupiter, taken June 27, 2019, revealed the giant planet's trademark great red spot and a more intense color palette in the clouds swirling in Jupiter's turbulent atmosphere than seen in previous years. The colors and their changes provide important clues to ongoing process in Jupiter's atmosphere. The new image was taken in visible light as part of the Outer Planets Atmosphere Legacy Program, or OPAL. The program provides yearly Hubble global views of the outer planets to look for changes in their storms, winds, and clouds. Hubble's Wide Field Camera 3 observed Jupiter when the planet was 400 million miles from Earth. So that's about 400 million miles of that. I'm wondering how far Jupiter is, because Earth is one astronomical unit, which is 100 million miles. So if this was 400 million miles, this has to be 400 astronomical. That can't be right, because I thought 1 million miles is one astronomical. So maybe they were on different sides of the solar system, but it doesn't make sense. I don't think this is right. To me, I'll look it up. The planet was 400 million miles from Earth. So I thought Jupiter was 8 to 10 astronomical, 12, 11 astronomical units from Earth. So one astronomical unit is 100 million. Okay. Oh, it does make sense. Okay. So I was making wrong. I thought it was a 1 million mile. So between Earth and the Sun is 100 million miles. So if Jupiter was 400 million miles, it means it was 4 astronomical units. So I was wrong to say it was 8, 9, or 10. Maybe that's Saturn. So I guess it was 4 astronomical units from Earth. Okay, sorry for mixing everybody up. I was mixing myself up. Okay, among the most. So again, this is an article on NASA.gov, dated August 8th. It says, Hubble's new portrait of Jupiter. Among the most striking features in the image are the rich colors of the clouds moving through the Great Red Spot, a storm rolling counterclockwise between two bands of clouds. These two cloud bands, above and below the Great Red Spot, are moving in opposite direction. So I see there's the Great Red Spot, and there's a color band above it moving, but they're saying there's another band below it. It could be that it is hard to see what it is, because below the spot there is like kind of grayish tones. So I would assume that the storm is the red stuff, and maybe below it is gray. And because it's a still photo, we are unable to see the movement of the thing. So I don't know where it is. So anyway, okay. These two color bands above and below the Great Red Spot are moving in opposite directions. The red band above and to the right, northeast of the Great Spot, contains clouds moving westward and around the north of the giant tempest. The white clouds to the left, southwest of the storm, are moving eastward to the south of the spot. So, yeah, it says white clouds, so we can't see them because they're not colorful. All of Jupiter's colorful cloud bands in this image are confined to the north and south by jet streams that remain constant even when the bands change color. The bands are all separated by winds that can reach speeds up to 400 miles per hour or 644 kilometers per hour. So what time is it? 49. Let's see. Do I want to add a nice song? Because what's happened is, you know, you guys are tired of listening to me, aren't you? You are, aren't you? Admit it. You're tired of listening to me. So I'm going to put on a song now. And when we come back, we'll talk more astronomy. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. Or is your vision getting a little bit hazy? Or, if you're feeling a bit funny, get your friends and listen to CITR 101.9 on Astro Talk with Marco at UBC. Depend on Marco for the latest in astronomy news at CITR's Astro Talk. Get a lot smarter now by listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. Okay, I'm back with all my friends on CITR 101.9. So, imagine this. Some alien comes, some alien being or alien race comes to Earth, and they say, what did Spock say? Live well and prosper? Whatever. Okay. So they come, and then they show us a representative video of your race. And then we show them TLC. What about your friends? How are they going to react? I really don't know. Okay, so I'm going to read some more about Jupiter. So the Great Red Spot is a structure shaped like a wedding cake. I wouldn't say a wedding cake, but anyway, that's what they're saying here. Whose upper haze layers extends more than 3 miles higher than the clouds in other areas. The gigantic structure with a diameter slightly larger than Earth. Just wait. Upper haze layer extends more than 3 miles. Okay, so just the upper haze area. Upper haze layer extends more than 3 miles up. Because here it says this gigantic structure with a diameter slightly larger than Earth, so the storm is diameter slightly larger than Earth, is a high pressure wind system called an anticyclone that has been slowly downsizing since the 1800s. The reason for this change in size is still unknown. Okay, a worm-shaped feature located below the Great Red Spot is a cyclone, a vortex around a low-pressure area with winds spinning in the opposite direction from the Great Red Spot. Interesting stuff. Just wait, I got to make sure I'm on the right mic because my brain is not functioning well sometimes, I guess. Okay. Researchers observed cyclones with a wide variety of different appearances across the planet. The two white oval-shaped features are anticyclones, the small versions of the Great Red Spot. So let's see if I can see this because there's a Great Red Spot and there's supposed to be some anticyclones maybe moving outside. The picture is up there, so when I read it, I can't see it as I'm reading it. Okay, so the two white oval-shaped features are anticyclones. So let's see. The two white oval-shaped features. Okay, I see that. Okay. Anyway, Jupiter, that great red spot, has been photographed a lot and has been shown a lot. So I believe it's quite well known. So everybody knows about the great red spot. Okay. Another interesting detail is the color of the wide band in the equator. The bright orange color may be a sign that deeper clouds are starting to clear out, emphasizing red particles in the overlying haze. So I'll read that again because I went through it and didn't sink in. So that happens sometimes. Another interesting detail is the color of the wide band at the equator. Okay, there. So I see that. There's a wide band at the equator. The bright orange color may be a sign that deeper clouds are starting to clear out, emphasizing red particles in the overlying haze. So imagine I can't begin. I'm sure there's a lot of experts that know about clouds and all this and wind and something in the earth. And it's probably very complicated, wind systems and things like that. But imagine Jupiter's with this great red spot and winds moving in opposite directions and cyclones and anticyclones and vortices and anti-vortices and uncle vortices. Was that funny? I don't know. The new image was taken in visible light as part of the Outer Planets Atmosphere Legacy Program, or OPAL. The program provides yearly Hubble Global Views of the outer planets to look for changes in their storm, winds, and cloud. Hubble's Wide Field Camera 3 observed Jupiter when the planet was 400 million miles from Earth, when Jupiter was near opposition or almost directly opposite the Sun in the sky. So there we have our big friend Jupiter. Will we ever travel to any of its moons in 100 and 200 years? We'll see. Okay, there, you know what I got? I'm bugging out now because I'm seeing that stupid astronaut jumping across jumping across the screen. It's driving me mad. Okay, so I'm going to look at CubeSat now. What's CubeSat? Okay, I'll read this article dated August 2nd, 2019, and it said, CubeSats dance. One water-powered NASA spacecraft commands another in orbit. On June 21st, 2019, NASA demonstrated the first coordinated maneuver between two CubeSats in low Earth orbit as part of NASA's Optical Communications and Sensor Demonstration Mission. The twin spacecraft, each approximately the size of a tissue box, were orbiting Earth about 5.5 miles apart when they established a radio frequency communications crosslinks to talk with each other. One spacecraft issued a command to the second to activate its thruster and close the gap between the two. The fuel tanks on both spacecraft are filled with water. During this propulsive maneuver, the water was converted to steam by the thrusters to propel the spacecraft. Now, doesn't that look interesting? So it makes me think, anyway, in the future, if spacecrafts are way out in outer space and they're trying to propel themselves, why not use water? Now, that's pretty interesting. But where do we get water? Well, we get water from asteroids, and we can get hydrogen, two hydrogens and an oxygen, react them together and get water. So we can get this stuff from asteroids or the moon or stuff. So we have to learn to live off the land, just like Sir John Franklin when he went around the Arctic. He didn't live off the land. He brought all these cans and materials, and he froze to death in the ice. So we have to learn to live off the land. How are we going to live off asteroids and comets and planets? Interesting. Okay, so says Roger Hunter. You know what? I don't know how many times, but somebody can, just like they vet Trump, they vet how often he lies. So you can vet me. How often do I say interesting? Probably quite a few times during each show. So I'm going to go on. So says Roger Hunter, program manager of the Small Spacecraft Technology Program, and quote, demonstrations such as this will help advance technologies that will allow for greater and more extended use of small spacecraft in and beyond Earth orbit, end quote. So I'm going to read that again because I saw two little kids walking by. They were cute. And while I was reading, I was eyeing the kids, so I didn't have the faintest clue of what I just said. So I'll say it again. Demonstrations such as this will help advance technologies that will allow for greater and more extended use of small spacecraft in and beyond Earth orbit. Okay, so we're going to get new technologies will allow for greater and more extended use of small spacecraft. So more small spacecraft can work in and beyond Earth orbit. The demonstration was designed with a series of safeguards to, you know, a lot of kids walking by, and they're distracting me. So I'll say that again. The demonstration was designed with a series of safeguards to ensure that only a pre-planned and authorized maneuver could take place. While it was choreographed by human operators on the ground, the demonstration showed it's possible for a series of propulsion maneuvers to be planned with onboard processing and executed cooperatively by a group of small spacecraft. So says Darren Rowan, a director of the Small Satellite Department of the Aerospace Corporation, and quote, the OCSD team is very pleased to continue demonstrating new technical capabilities as part of this extended mission over 1.5 years after deployment. It is exciting to think about the possibilities enabled with respect to deep space, autonomously organizing swarms of small spacecraft. Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to sign off to see what can I end the program with. I guess this is not about astronomy. This is about America. What's happening down there? It's madness. What purpose do they need to work for now? They are killing each other and destroying each other, and they can't agree that how to solve it. So anyway, it seems to me the NRA, and maybe there's some NRA fans out there, but anyway, they're interested in the status quo. So if nothing gets done, if they don't make any changes to any gun laws, they're happy. But what happens is people get killed, and a lot of people got killed, and the next time more people get killed. And it seems that as long as they can keep their guns, they will live with the status quo, and they'll accept the fact that a lot of people are dying here and there. So anyway, maybe I shouldn't have said that, but here I did, and we're off now. So now I'm going to play some music, and thank you for listening. This was Marco. You have been listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9, or you have listened to. Bye.